There, do you have any idea what you're listening to?
London Philharmonic?
It's Venus.
Huh?
Venus.
Why not? We bounced signals off the moon's surface. There's no reason that Venus shouldn't radiate impulses.
I don't mean the static. Can't you hear it, the other thing?
What other thing?
Listen to it, Paul. Listen to the voice.
Hello and welcome to Media Geek. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. My name is Paul Reisman-Ellen. I'm your host. On today's program, we step a little bit outside of typical Media Geek territory and take a look at the environment and global warming and a possible innovative solution for it. It's pretty interesting, and that's why I'm bringing it to you. But we'll also do some media stuff. I'll let you know where Congress is with regard to what they're going to do with the future of the internet. You will want to stay tuned. On May 9th, Halliburton representative Fred Wolf delivered a demonstration of his company's newest technology to a LexisNexis-sponsored conference on catastrophic loss. This innovative technology is designed to address head-on the problems that global warming presents. I was lucky enough to talk with the busy Mr. Wolf on the morning of May 12th, not long after he completed an appearance on the national syndicated program, Democracy Now! To start, can you tell me about the exciting new technology that Halliburton's come out with to solve the problem of global warming?
Yes. As you know, Halliburton is very concerned about global warming. It's a phenomenon that scientists agree is accelerating and is not only leading to disasters at the present day, but is increasingly likely to lead to a catastrophic event, which would essentially endanger a good chunk of human civilization. If the Gulf Stream stops, for example, Europe is going to enter an ice age. Various other scenarios could lead to worldwide heat events or widespread flooding, which could bury most of the Earth's major cities underwater. Of course, if we want to stop that from happening, that's basically a form of panic, and it would require the reduction of our emissions, our carbon emissions, by about 70%, which would really cut into corporate profits. So the only rational solution is to protect the drivers of progress, those who power progress, from the effects of these increasingly likely events. And that's why we've invented the Survivaball. Yeah, it's a big orb about 2 meters in diameter, and in the event of a climate change catastrophe that's endangering a significant portion of humanity, you simply the manager enters the ball and closes it and is protected from everything. It can go through water, snow, fire, ice. It can fall from a great height. It can go underwater for brief periods. Various balls can also link up into a sort of a substrate, a managerial substrate that can survive climate change events indefinitely, regardless of whether there's any infrastructure. It can also protect against attacks, because in such a scenario, various groups, mostly affluent, are going to be battling each other. And so the survival balls enable managers to defend against marauding wealthy people.
And this new technology, how long has it been in development?
Oh, since 2001. That was the moment when danger became a priority, and climate change also coincidentally around the time became accepted as a reality by most people. and we just had to accept the overwhelming preponderance of evidence and the consensus of science that this is happening. So it's been about 5 years.
Wow. And you just debuted this technology. Was it May 9th at the Catastrophic Loss Conference?
Yes, May 9th was our launch date. We launched it at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel in Amelia Island, Florida, at a LexisNexis conference on catastrophic loss. It was an insurance conference. Many insurance industry representatives were there, especially lawyers who work with the industry. And we launched it. We demonstrated three survivor balls into which we put myself as well as two volunteers from the audience. And showed how it worked, showed some video about it. Democracy Now! Has some video of it showing. And it went over quite well. The audience was appreciative, asked some pertinent and incisive questions about whether this technology will be useful against terrorism. It will not, except terrorism, of course, of the those who have the means to actually get around, which is essentially the wealthy from neighboring communities. The other questions involved other technical matters, as well as a question about the cost. And we had to say, well, the cost is going to be quite high.
Did you get any orders already?
Not any firm orders, but it's still in development. I mean, it's not quite finished. We still have time. So we're not too worried.
So maybe we can now reveal that indeed you don't work for Halliburton directly.
I'm fired? Oh my God.
So I've heard.
Started. That was quick, and we did such good work. Oh, that's terrible. Oh well, I guess now I can talk to you as the Yes Men.
So you were part of the group of the Yes Men, and my question is at the conference, were you outed or did you out yourself?
Nope, neither. No, we expected to be outed as we usually do. This time we were almost certain we would be outed because it's so preposterous, and the video was so over the top. One time you see one of these survivor balls wandering through a field and going up to a cow and sucking out its innards and then dancing around in a field of cow skeletons. And we thought, well, for sure, we're going to be called out. But we weren't. We just, I guess something about our tone of voice and our association with Halliburton reassured people that this was real. We left a good feeling all around. One person in the audience realized it had to be comedy, but only one. Didn't see any other smiles.
And so the questions that you received from the audience were sincere.
Yes, they were. Apparently, at least we couldn't tell that they weren't. I think they were.
And have you heard anything from LexisNexis or the other people at the conference since you've sent out your press release and revealed that this is not necessarily the work of Halliburton?
No, I think they probably don't want to. They want to have as little contact with us as possible, I think.
I suppose that might be true. It looks like the first press report I've seen showed up today, actually, in the Washington Times.
Yeah, I was surprised about that.
In the hallowed halls of journalism there.
Well, the Moonies are into survival as well, I suppose. It was an okay article. A couple of grammatical errors, but nothing bad.
And so how much planning had to go into getting into this conference and pulling off this particular presentation?
A lot of planning had to go into it, as it usually does. There's a bit of organization involved. but everything went quite smoothly, pretty much without a hitch. We had three people helping us and filming and so on. And, we we started planning about 2 months ago.
And why did you choose Halliburton and this conference for this presentation?
Well, the title of the conference is just so appealing, Catastrophic Loss. I mean, it's funny. It's an industry conference, and the word catastrophe was in there. And, of course, that's really the key word these days when you look at industry and what's happening to the world. The world is facing catastrophe, of course. And so it seemed like the right venue. And Halliburton's kind of an icon of catastrophe. It not only helps generate it through its energy business, but it also helps, it also profits from it extensively in Iraq, in New Orleans, and elsewhere. So it's kind of a good poster child for the way business is dealing with catastrophe.
Now, this is not, it's not a very high-profile conference, though. It's not, you know, like the G8 or something larger like that.
Right. We would have had a harder time getting into the G8. But no, it's not a very high-profile conference. It's just a typical conference, a typical cross-section of the business community went there, mostly lawyers in this case, but lawyers who work with insurance companies and other businesses. Corporate lawyers. And no, it wasn't a huge conference, but just one of many hundreds that are going on at any given moment in the United States.
Well, and given that it is sort of a small, it's really like a true industry conference and not really something which is going to generate a lot of press attention, why is that a good venue for this sort of presentation, this sort of stunt, if you will?
Well, the news is here that, you know, that we got into this conference and that we made a statement and about these survivaballs and presented them very clearly as what they are, which is a way to help managers escape the disasters that they've caused. And there was no flinching whatsoever. But the lack of any reaction is really the news here. And of course it's not newsworthy in itself that the conference happened and that they were fooled, but we can by issuing a press release about it, we generate interest that way. So really, I mean, if Halliburton reacts or LexisNexis reacts, then it will become more newsworthy. And that's, of course, what we're hoping for.
Were you surprised that there was apparently no negative reaction, that no one seemed to be on to you except for maybe one person?
Yes, very surprised.
And why do you think that is?
I don't know. Perhaps simply because it's reasonable. It's the way it actually works. I mean, we did build the case for this survivaball through historical examples and through current examples. We pointed out that many disasters have been good for humanity, such as the Black Plague, which many scholars believe led to the Renaissance, and the Great Deluge, which, although it destroyed the world, it gave Noah a monopoly of the animals. Not bad. And then we, you know, outlined that we are currently building sort of Noah's Arks for various situations, and you know, the Iraq War is a way of kind of keeping the arc of our national interests afloat in a world of disquiet. And gated communities are kind of like Noah's Arks in the sea of the unknown that surrounds us. And so, really, this survivaball is a kind of gated community for one. And, you know, building it up that way in a kind of reasonable way, I guess, just disarms people. And they thought, oh, okay, not bad. I guess that's okay, since we are doing things that way already. And, you know, that is the truth. I mean, many people are, of course, already living in survival balls. They were nice people, though. They were perfectly nice people. They were actually very nice people. The volunteers who put on the suits were very gracious about it and played their part very nicely. And you know, they worked fun. people. They were actually very nice. There's nothing wrong with them. Of course, that's the tragedy. You can't actually tell what people are doing in their business lives based on how they behave as people.
So are you waiting for the phone to ring then for somebody else besides Media Geek at this time? Or
that's right. Yeah, just going through the email and seeing what sort of press response there is. And yeah, that's about it.
And are you is the group already making plans for the next event?
Yes, we are.
How many different events? I don't know, what you do you call them, hoaxes? Do you call them events? What do you usually try to call them?
All of that, yeah.
All of that, okay. I don't want to ruin up your nomenclature or call them something they're not. How many do you try to do in a year and give them time? Because the last one I really remember hearing about is when you appeared on television as Dow Chemical, talking about reparations for Bhopal.
Yeah, we've done two or three since then.
Okay.
Yeah, we appeared at a banking conference and touted a golden skeleton as a symbol for basically profit should human death should not get in the way of profits, and there is such a thing as a golden skeleton in the closet, a terrible event that actually turned out lucrative, and that should be positive. And there again, we got nothing but appreciation and positive reactions, and a couple of other conferences as well.
Okay, so you keep a pretty full schedule then, and then occasionally one is very high profile where you'll appear on television or something like that?
Yeah, that's when we really luck out.
And then that's probably a lot harder to do as well, my guess
it's,
would be.
It's about the same in terms, well, it involves much less preparation. So Dow, when we appeared on the BBC, it took 5 days to prepare. That's all the time we had. But yes, it's even more nerve-wracking.
Is there a particular key to not getting fingered or outed, or is it just luck?
We've never been fingered or outed. I don't know what the key is. We keep expecting to be, and we keep almost trying to be, to be pointing out that what we're doing is really horrific. What we're saying there as this corporation is really horrific. But, no, if you find out, if you figure it out, if you ever get outed, then let us know. We need to know how it's done.
That was Fred Wolf of Hal, or actually Andy Bickelbaum of the Yes Men, discussing that group's latest hoax, taking aim at Halliburton and everyone looking to profit from natural and man-made disaster. More information about the Survival Ball can be had at HalliburtonContracts.com. Learn more about the Yes Men at theyesmen.org, and you can hear an interview with another Yes Man, Mike Bonanno, talking about their BBC television appearance on behalf of Dow Chemical on the December 24th, 2004 edition of the Media Geek Radio Show at radio.mediageek.net. And you are listening to Media Geek. Check out Media Geek online at mediageek.net, where I post frequent updates with news of our media environment, as well as other stuff that I don't have time for on this program. And you can download the program at radio.mediageek.net in MP3 in the open source Ogvorbis format. You can also subscribe to the podcast to have it automatically downloaded to your computer or MP3 player. If you have any comments about the program, please send them to me, paul@mediageek.net. And the Congressional Sausage Factory continues to grind slowly on the meat of this year's big telecommunications bill, while the movement supporting a free and open internet continues to gain steam. Both the House and Senate are working on bills that are intended to speed the entry of the big telephone companies into the cable TV market around the country by establishing a so-called national franchise, which limits the power of local municipalities to negotiate the terms that a new cable company must meet in order to begin offering service. The national franchise would give the likes of AT&T and Verizon an enormous leg up in offering cable TV compared to the incumbent cable operators like Comcast, which had to establish individual franchise contracts with every single municipality they serve. The telcos say that establishing individual franchises is a long and expensive process, While a national franchise is pro-competitive and creates more choice in TV services for consumers. Critics say that the telcos don't need a national franchise, their entry into the cable TV market isn't being slowed, and that they haven't really even tried. The Michigan Municipal League and the Michigan Townships Association say there are 600 invitations across that state, covering nearly 60% of the population, asking AT&T to sign local franchise agreements to begin offering cable TV service. In a May 8th press release, David Bertram, a legislative liaison for the Michigan Townships Association, said, quote, "Local communities are open for business, and the only thing stopping AT&T from entering Michigan's cable market is AT&T," end quote. On May 10th, the New York City Council voted unanimously to urge its congressional representatives to vote against the bills that would create a national franchise. The council resolution states that the current bills would, quote, "severely undermine community programming and the implementation of universal, affordable broadband access," end quote. The House bill has already passed out of the Energy and Commerce Committee without any strong provisions to guarantee network neutrality, but it hasn't yet made it to the House floor. The House Judiciary Committee is requesting review of that bill. Chairman James Sensenbrenner is a strong critic of the major telephone companies and their monopoly-like power. Thus, a judiciary review could have a significant impact on the final bill. Network neutrality supporters are hopeful that a Judiciary Committee review would provide another opportunity to include language that would preserve the open nature of the Internet, prohibiting broadband providers like AT&T from slowing or blocking rich multimedia content coming from other companies or groups on the Internet. Similarly, the Senate Judiciary Committee is making noises that it would like to review the Senate's version of the telecom bill, which hasn't even been marked up by the Commerce Committee. A judiciary aide told the National Journal that the panel has jurisdiction over network neutrality and that, quote, "it's basically a vertical integration issue that involves competition policy, not directly telecommunications policy," end quote. The Commerce Committee has hearings on the bill scheduled for May 18th and 25th. Markup on the bill is scheduled for June 8th. It's during markup where committee members vote on provisions for inclusion in the bill, and there's a good chance that additions addressing network neutrality will be offered up. One possible worry for Commerce Chairman Ted Stevens is that Senate rules allow any senator to place a hold on a bill and stop progress indefinitely. Although a politically risky move, the threat of a hold can give a public interest-minded senator some leverage to force the inclusion of network neutrality provisions. A national cable franchise is not the only controversial item included in these telecom bills. The current draft of the Senate bill throws a large bone to the entertainment industry, with language authorizing the FCC to institute a broadcast flag. If the flag survives into a final bill signed into law, the FCC would be able to require electronics manufacturers to place control of all digital media recording devices into the hands of the entertainment industry. Content creators like television networks, film studios, and record labels would then be able to flag programs which could not be recorded by VCRs, DVD recorders, PVRs, or any other recording device. The broadcast flag would allow Hollywood to keep people from recording programs even when they are permitted to do so under copyright law. The broadcast flag is very unpopular with consumer groups, civil libertarians, and the electronics industry. Last year, the Federal Appeals Court invalidated an FCC regulation instituting a broadcast flag, ruling that the commission didn't have that level of authority over electronics manufacturers. That's why the entertainment industry has been pushing so hard on Congress to grant the FCC that authority. However, the broadcast flag is not contained in the current House bill. And so even if these telecom bills pass both houses of Congress, there will be many differences and details to be worked out in conference, whether Republican leadership can craft the legislation they want outside of public scrutiny. Indeed, that's exactly what one Republican leader is just waiting for. On May 2nd, Representative Fred Upton, chairman of the House Energy and Commerce Committee, told a telecommunications industry forum that it really doesn't matter what's in the bill that the Senate passes, so long as the Senate passes something. The real decisions will be made in conference, where the congressional Democrats can be excluded. One scenario that has internet freedom advocates worried is that congressional Republicans will choose to leave out any network neutrality provisions from the final telecommunications bill. Then they can stall the consideration of standalone net neutrality bills until after the November elections, so that Republicans can make the unpopular choice of not acting to preserve internet freedom without having to pay for it at the polls. However, as the clock keeps ticking away on this session of Congress, the future of cable television and the internet are still very much up in the air, and elected representatives may still be open to strong words on the subject from their constituents. I will continue to keep tabs on the network neutrality debate in Congress each week here on the radio show and on the web at MediaGeek.net. To learn more about how your congresspeople are voting or plan to vote on the future of the internet, go to SaveTheInternet.com. Last week on the program, I brought you an update about a proposal in front of the FCC to bring low-power radio to the AM dial and about some changes that the authors of that proposal have submitted in the hopes of increasing its chances of becoming reality. But there are also opportunities to broadcast with low power on the AM dial without a license and legally. One of the men behind the low-power AM proposal, Kyle Drake, is also an engineer who has dedicated many hours of work into researching and creating designs for efficient low-power AM broadcasting. Last year, he published a 100-page printed and bound guide full of information on regulation, schematics, and other engineering issues surrounding legal unlicensed LPAM. On May 10th, Drake released his guide for free onto the internet under a Creative Commons license, and you can download it in PDF format at his website, lpam.info. That brings to a close another edition of Media Geek. I'm your host and producer, Paul Riesmandel, and I'll be back in 1 week with more news about grassroots and independent media, as well as our media environment. In the meantime, check out Media Geek online at MediaGeek.net, where you'll find the Media Geek blog with frequently updated news and views about our media. You can also download the program at radio.mediageek.net or subscribe to the podcast to have it automatically downloaded to your computer or MP3 player. That's all at MediaGeek.net. The closing music is Fire in the Sky by Adam Lowow. Media Geek is produced live at Community Radio WEFT in Champaign, Illinois. Some segments are pre-recorded at Media Geek Studios. And Media Geek is heard on 9 other community stations around North America, including KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, KQRP in Salida, California, KRBS in Oroville, California, WSLR in Sarasota, Florida, WTND in Macomb, Illinois, WRFA in Jamestown, New York, WYQZ in Warrenton, Bealeton, Virginia, CKDU in Halifax, Nova Scotia, and Free Radio Olympia in Olympia, Washington. Media Geek is free to air on your local community radio station, too. Just drop me a line at paul@mediageek.org. That email address is also good for any comments you want to send in about the program. Once again, that's paul@mediageek.org. Thanks for tuning in.